Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to another episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvargen. Since my co-host Vicky's on the road again, it'll just be me and our guest today. So, I have a new opinion piece in the Los Angeles Times on the latest threat to our public seas and its citizens, both human and wild. That threat is draft legislation introduced by pro-Trump MAGA Congressman Nick Begich of Alaska. It aims to weaken the Marine Mammal Protection Act at a time when marine mammals are at greater risk than they've been in decades, really since the act first became law in 1972. Representative Jared Huffman of California, the top Democrat on the House Resources Committee, calls the proposed changes a death sentence for marine mammals. So I thought, let's ask an expert. Kirsten Donald is a marine mammal biologist, educator, and ocean advocate with the Pacific Marine Mammal Center in Laguna Beach. It's one of California's leading marine mammal rescue centers, where they also care for, rehabilitate, and release hundreds of sick and injured animals every year. Before coming to California, Kirsten worked for 18 years at the Dolphin Research Center in the Florida Keys, where she also helped found and direct the College of Marine Mammal Professions. In her 30-year career, she's worked on marine mammal care, strandings and rescues, and sometimes even had to do necropsies on those who didn't make it. The animals she's worked with include whales, dolphins, manatees, harbor seals, elephant seals, and sea lions. So, welcome, Kirsten.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Before we get into all those details, let me ask you, how and when did you first connect with the ocean?
Ever since I was a little girl, I got the pleasure of being able to go to the ocean because my family had lived in Maryland for a time. And I was just utterly fascinated. And I just remember seeing dolphins swimming by and being absolutely enamored by them. And I got further enamored when I saw them in marine parks because I was just like, wow, what an amazing mammal. Look at all the cool things they can do. And then, you know, later on in life, it was a really kind of a strange ride in that initially, when I went to college, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I kind of lost touch with that a little bit and went a different direction into more communications. And about 26, had a midlife crisis early and went back to career counseling and realized that I needed to be back in science and really reminded myself I loved animals. I happened to hear about this place called Dolphin Research Center that offered a program called Dolphin Lab, which allowed people to come down for a week and interact with their dolphin colony there. So I traveled all the way down to Florida and I just fell in love with the dolphins there and the mission to educate the public so that they're more compassionate to the conservation issues that we face with these guys in the wild. And after a bit, they asked me to apply for a job. And that was in 1997. And it's been doing it ever since.
and the Dolphin Research Center, just so people understand, it's not SeaWorld. Okay. It's not a entertainment.
Oh, no. Dolphin Research Center is part of the Alliance of Marine Mammal Parks and Aquariums. It has some of the highest standards in the world for the care of the animals. They are an educational nonprofit and research facility that has a colony of dolphins that were born there mostly. Some retired from other facilities, and then they have a number of animals that had stranded as babies and needed homes because they could not be put back in the wild. And so now the dolphins participate in everything from interactions with humans, so people can have that really close connection and actually realize that these animals should be conserved on the planet because they are very unique. And they also do a significant amount of research on the capabilities of these animals, both acoustically and cognitively, so we can understand the other species in the ocean and the parts they play in the ecosystem. So it's a really wonderful place. It's all about the dolphins first. I remember whenever we would do a session, we'd come down and if you had something in mind, the dolphin's like, no, you had to change gears. That was your job. It's like, you got to figure out what they want to do, because it's not about making them do anything. But the thing was, is we made everything a game and exciting and fun. And so the dolphins were always, you know, excited to come over and play. In fact, one of my favorite things to do was watch guests walk along the causeway, and they would go by a pool with these two dolphins named Delphine and Kibby, and people wouldn't see them sitting there, and they'd scream their heads off, and the people would stop and stare at the dolphins, and the dolphins would stare at them. But then the people would get bored and start walking away. They'd scream again, and the people would walk back. So effectively, they were training people to walk back and forth. And just the amount of times I saw them actively training people, including myself, it really made me aware that we are sharing this planet with other species that have a high level of cognition, and we need to have a respect for them sharing this planet. And that's, you know, really my drive behind conservation, is the fact that we are not the owners of this planet. We share it.
And so you were almost 30, you've moved from Indiana to Florida. And what was your day-to-day over the next 18 years that you were Florida-based?
Okay, so when I was in Florida, before I came to PMMC, I started out as an educator and trainer. So the educators were trainers, and we would teach people about different seminars, whether it be about biology, maternity, things like that, as well as conservation. And so we would teach these things and facilitate interactions between the dolphins. I also got involved a bit in the research, whether it was taking behavioral research observations, or later on, we started developing a field research program on bottlenose dolphins in the Middle Keys, which had never been done before. And they're still doing that and have expanded that program today, which is really phenomenal. I became the director of education and further became the director of the College of Marine Mammal Professions, which basically took all of the different Dolphin Lab week-long classes that people would come to. All of them were college accredited already through the local college, but we realized that we had the ability and the structure to create our own college and be able to grant an associate's degree in marine mammal behavior and care and training, which was the first one in the world. And students would come down to DRC and actually learn how to become a trainer, how to care for the animals, how to get involved in research. So it's a really phenomenal program that they're still running today. It's just a wonderful place that its heart is about connecting people to the animals so that they will then feel compassionate. And that compassion then is a way you can motivate them to action. And that's something I still believe highly in today. By connecting people to the animals and their issues, people really start to become compassionate, and you can share with them those messages of what needs to be done to help these animals survive.
So you were 18 years there in Florida. What got you connected with the Marine Center?
At the time, I'd been at DRC for 18 years, and believe me, it was the hardest change I ever had to make, because all of those dolphins were very much a part of my family. They were like my kids, and as well as the people. And so that was a really difficult choice. But my daughter was growing up, and I wanted her to have access to more opportunities. Keys are kind of rural in a way, island community. And all of a sudden, this job popped up at Pacific Marine Mammal Center to run the education department. And so I decided to check it out. And it reminded me very much of DRC when I first started. When I started at DRC, there was like only 30 employees. And by the time I left, there was over 100 plus even more volunteers. And so I came to PMMC, and we only had about 15 people at the time, and just a handful of education programs. And I could see that there were so many opportunities to widen the education and really reach a more diverse audience. So I knew that there's a lot of work that I could help with. But in addition, it gave me the opportunity to learn more about pinnipeds, meaning seals and sea lions, which, you know, I didn't interact with much. So this gave me exposure to that, which was really interesting, plus a direct connection to conservation work that was firsthand conservation work.
Rather than studying research, you're actually rescuing stranded animals,
right?
Sick or injured.
Exactly.
Tell us about that. How extensive is that? How many animals a year the center works with?
Right. You're right. It's direct conservation. We're dealing with the problems that are happening right now in the ocean. And so PMMC rescues typically in any given year, anywhere from like 100 to 200 pinnipeds and a few cetaceans as well.
For regular folks, would be seals, sea lions, and dolphins.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Seals, sea lions, and dolphins. And there have been years also where it was crazy. Like my first year at Pacific Marine Mammal Center happened to be the worst year on record for strandings. It was back in 2015. And from 2013 to 2016, we had an unusual mortality event because of that warm water blob overlapping with the El Nino. The waters were ridiculously warm. And in 2015, PMMC rescued over 500 animals. And that was much more than we typically rescue. And it was due to the fact that since the warm water is there, the fish like colder water. So they would either go deeper or further out to sea or further up north. And the pups that are on the islands couldn't swim that far in order to get nutrition. In addition, the mothers that are tied to the islands can't swim very far away because they've got to nurse their pups. And so it became a situation where mothers were abandoning pups. Pups weren't getting enough to eat. And so there was just constant influx of these animals. And it was crazy because my second week at PMMC, all the trucks are out. All the rescuers are out. And then the stranding coordinator came up to me and said, "You're the only person I have left. Here's a net. Here's a kennel. Take the car and go to this beach." And I'm like, "I've never done this before." "It's fine. You just pick them up and put them in the kennel, you know?" And I'm like, "Okay, I'll give it a try." And so I went, and the sea lion happened to be a very small pup that was on a pier, San Clemente Pier, curled up, didn't even move when I picked him up. He was so emaciated. And so I popped him in the kennel. And then this lady ran up to me and she's like, "There's another one over here. He's really skinny." And, you know, I'm from a different background in terms of when you work with animals that are in human care and managed care, you introduce them slowly. You know, you let them get to know each other. And I only had one kennel. And I'm like, "How could I put another animal in this kennel? I can't do that. What should I do?" You know, so I call her and she goes, "Oh, no, just get him and put him in there with them. They don't care. Just shove him in and they'll be fine." I'm like,
This is triage. This is emergency right. room activity.
Right. Not exactly. So, yeah. And this is also me not being as familiar at the time with sea lion behavior because they do lie over each other. They create piles. And so, especially as pups. And so I went and this one was going in and out of the water and I had to actually get the net and get between it and the water so I could net it and then put it in the kennel and bring it back. So that was my very first rescue. And I named the animals Yin and Yang because they were very different. And it was quite the experience.
And as you say, it was a traumatic time because it was the first, the blob was the first of these major marine heat waves that were experienced.
Yes,
the fossil fuel
exactly.
climate change. So loss of prey, there was starvation at the time. Mm-hmm. It's also supercharge some of these HABs, these harmful algal blooms that can poison.
Yes, exactly. And that's what happened this year. We have had the worst harmful algal bloom on record. These animals are struggling right now with regard to climate change, as well as plastics and chemicals in the ocean. I can give you two really good examples. Number one, the gray whale, which was actually a huge success under the MMPA. It was one of the major successes of the MMPA. They were the first large whale species to be delisted after whaling. They were almost decimated and they came back 27,000 strong. And between 2019 and 2023, their population plummeted down to 13,000 animals. So half the population gone. And scientists looked into it and discovered that this was very much connected to climate change. Basically, what was happening is since the ice cover was receding earlier and the algae, instead of falling to the bottom and feeding the amphipods, the ice would recede, the fish go in, eat up all the algae, amphipods die, and these guys go up there to eat the amphipods, there's not enough up there. And so they spend longer and longer trying to fish, expending more and more energy, but they're still coming back emaciated. And so they were dying in droves all up and down the coast from Canada to Mexico. So it was an international event. And it actually, they closed the UME after 2023, and just this this year, we are already having a ton of these animals strand up north around the Monterey Bay area starting again. It's considered unusual mortality event because it's something that we normally don't see and is not a natural cycle. And so they thought it had been over in 2023. And just this year in 2025, it began again. And so these guys are not out of trouble. In fact, if they can lose half their population just in a few years, this is the worst time to take away their protections. The other example is just that, you know, California sea lions, they breed around the Channel Islands. And one of the studies that our veterinarian did was in looking at the high levels of DDT in these California sea lions, because there's DDT barrels that were dumped back in the 60s around those islands. And DDT is a very toxic, persistent organic pollutant, which is basically a fertilizer. And it stays in the environment for thousands of years. These animals are accumulating it through nursing as well as the food that they eat. And what we've discovered is that they will develop cancer because that DDT interacts with a sea lion herpes virus, which pretty much they all have. And it is a catalyst for cancer. And so about 25% of the adult patients that come through PMMC are diagnosed with terminal cancer, unfortunately. And that's the highest rate of cancer in any mammal on the planet. So again, we're dealing with human impacts on these species already. And so they need the protections we have. In fact, that they need more protections than the MMPA provides currently.
You had a few decades where it was working. The manatees went from 1,000 to 10,000 off of Florida.
Right. And the other one that I'm really concerned about as well is the North Atlantic right whale. There's only 370 of them left. And the changes that are proposed actually will delay any action to help them further with reducing entanglements or ship strikes, which are the two major things that are hurting their population. And they don't have 10 years to wait because they've lost half their population since 2017. So you can see the trajectory that they're already on. The Marine Mammal Protection Act is great. It has helped a lot of species, but there are still species that need even more protection, like North Atlantic right whales. Taking away these protections is going to be devastating. They're going to, you know, the bycatch restrictions, which means it's going to allow even fishing practices that are more damaging and cause more harm to these animals. So that's, you know, a real problem with animals that are struggling due to prey depletion, ocean acidification, altered migration patterns, you know, all of those things are changing, and we really can't afford for these changes to be made.
Do you love the salty characters and ocean champions we have on The Rising Tide? So do we, and we're dedicated to bringing inspiring stories and voices that make waves. But here's the catch. We need your support to keep the tide rolling. A tax-deductible donation at bluefront.org will help keep The Rising Tide on the air and online. If you're ready and able to amplify these salty voices for the sea, dive in with a donation, big or small. Visit bluefront.org and join the movement. And now, back to the show.
They're trying to roll back all environmental protections. A Keystone Protection, the NEPA, the National Environmental Protection Act. People may not know the details on that. The Marine Mammal Protection Act, it's right there in the name. We, in the 1990s, popular movements got us to dolphin-free tuna, which was...
Right.
They used to put the nets around schools of dolphins because they know they were above the tuna, and they killed the dolphins along with the tuna. Under this so-called reform of the Marine Mammal Protection Act, there's nothing to stop them from doing that again.
Exactly. And we do need the power of the public right now. And I think that that's what everything going on in society is telling us, is that people really need to step up and get involved.
Yes, people need to not only volunteer to help the marine mammal centers like yours.
Yeah.
Also to call their congresspeople and senators and say this.
Exactly. that's something that we talk about all the time. And this is why I am such a big proponent of education. I mean, your podcast is education, talking about it is education, but helping people understand that they have power, they have a voice. I think a lot of us have forgotten that. And to be able to stand up and call your congressman, if everybody is doing that and letting them know that they care about these issues. And, you know, gee, if you're a congressperson and you're not listening to your constituents, you know, you're probably not going to get reelected. And you're there to represent the people's interest. And so we need people to express that interest. And so that's why we teach about all the things we do. A really great example of that is in looking at the southern resident killer whales. They're iconic species. Everybody knows them. Everybody loves them. They are, these particular residents are iconic for the Pacific Northwest of America. And there are only 73 of these animals left. They are critically endangered. And they have a synergy of human impacts happening upon them right now. Number one, the loss of salmon, which is their primary food source. So they are starving. They are then also, while, you know, when marine mammals go through famine, they actually utilize their blubber to feed themselves as an energy source. But what they also do when they encounter toxins is the toxins get locked away in the fat. So it doesn't harm the system. But when your system starts breaking down fat for food, that enters their system and starts causing reproductive and health problems. And so these animals are facing that. They're also facing noise pollution. They hunt using echolocation. And when large ships come in, they create noise that the animals can no longer hear their echolocation clicks to find food. And so they have to stop hunting. And so they lose a lot of ground. And in fact, they've been finding that they've been trying to hunt at night. They're not very effective at it as they are during the day. So the animals are trying to adapt around the challenges that we're throwing at them, but they're struggling. And so rolling back these protections, you know, because part of the protection that is rolling back is the idea of harassment and things that disturb animals doing their natural things that help them survive. And that's an exact example for killer whales, not regulating noise in an environment.
Right. And again, there's this disingenuous argument being put forward by Republican sponsors of rolling back the Endangered Species Act, Marine Mammal Protection. Which is, these laws have worked so well that these animals are no longer at risk. And this is complete bunk. They're more at risk today than in generations.
Exactly.
Let me personalize it with the Pacific Marine Mammal Center. Who are some of your patients right now? What do they look like?
Oh, well, actually, our patients are all gone. We're excited. We had a really tough year with the unusual mortality event we went through with the harmful algal bloom, because I got to tell you, it was very rough. Literally, most of the animals that came in, or at least half of them, had to be euthanized because they had too many toxins in their system that damaged their brain. Because that's what happens with domoic acid poisoning. Domoic acid is produced by the algae and the fish eat it. And then the sea lions eat the fish and get concentrated doses. And that toxin goes to the brain, damages it, and it doesn't allow them to be able to navigate spatially. They do things they're not normally doing.
They wander up on the highways. There was a lot of publicity about a sea lion that was biting surfers. That was a 16.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. People were up in arms about sea lions biting, and they don't normally do that. They normally leave you alone. They go away. But the animals were so out of their minds because their brains were damaged that they were being aggressive. And so there were quite a large number of animals that we had to euthanize. And what was even sadder is that the majority of California sea lions that came in, like they should be doing every year, is breeding, and they were pregnant. And they were not yet close to term. They were about maybe 3/4 of the way through their pregnancies, but they were having to euthanize these females. And in some cases, they'd have to induce abortions to try to save the females, because there's so many toxins in the amniotic fluid that the female can reabsorb those unless we induce abortion. And so what's even sadder is when they would induce these abortions, some of the pups would try to take a breath, even though that they were not viable yet. They were not fully developed. And so literally as the babies were coming out, they were brought to the veterinarian, who then then had to turn around and euthanize them. So it was a really traumatic year for our animal care. And it's really worrisome that, again, this is the fourth year in a row that we've had a harmful algal bloom, and this was the worst on record. What are we in store for in years to come? And so that's, you know, a real concern of ours. So it was a tough year.
We're having to deal with increased marine heat waves, which are linked to fossil fuel fired climate change. And we're, you know, at the federal level, we're both denying the reality of climate change and now trying to deny the reality that marine mammals are at risk.
Right. And when you look at things happening in the ocean, there's no denying climate change anymore. There's absolutely none. It's happening. It's affecting the animals. They're showing it to us. It's sad when we have these animals, we get them back up to speed. They're ready to go out. They're healthy. And then we realize we're releasing them into a damaged home, a broken home that we need to help fix because we broke it. And so it's really personal to us. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the work you're doing. And let's end on a happy note. What was your last release?
The last release I was on, it was great because I got to go with my entire staff with some animal care people out on a boat release, because sometimes it's better to release the animals on boats, especially if they're like adult animals. We get them further away from the beach so they don't present a hazard to people. That's where they're normally meant to be, is further out in the ocean. And so we had three different animals, and you would basically move the crate up to the edge of the boat and open the kennel, and they look around, they dunk their head in the water and look around, and then slowly climb in, and then you just do one after the other. And it's sometimes it is funny because I've seen elephant seals do the same thing, where one will like stick his head in the water, then look at his buddy and wait for the buddy to go in, and then look in the water and make sure, you know, I'm thinking he's making sure there's no sharks, you know, let his buddy go first.
Right, absolutely.
Exactly. So it's neat. And sometimes they, you know, they'll look back at us too, you know, and we like to think it's a, you know, thank you. Thank you for helping me. And then they just swim away and do what they're meant to be doing. So it's really gratifying to see them go home, but it gives us even more motivation to try to help get word out about these issues so that, you know, people can take action in their own lives to help, because they're all simple things that we can do, you know, whether it be reducing the amount of plastics in our lives, which is absolutely essential now, reducing the carbon emissions that we have going on. You know, there's all sorts of things people can do to help. But right now, this help that we can provide is standing up for the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Environment or the Endangered Species Act, because they are the two strongest, most important acts that have been passed in the United States that also are unique. They're ecosystem approached rather than just species based. And so it's a very effective way to try to help the environment.
Absolutely. So protect the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Endangered Species Act. Check out the Pacific Marine Mammal Center. And Kirsten Donald, thank you so much for being with me on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helbart and me, Vicki Nichols-Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear, it's true. It's the Blue Frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.